Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about economics today to begin the show, and you'll get a breakdown of topics like the tariffs, inflation, interest rates with our guest, Russ Cation. He's an economics professor at UW-Whitewater. Russ is also the director of the Fiscal and Economic Research Center at UW-Whitewater. And as we talk with Russ, I hope you'll join in with your questions about the economy. Which part has always seemed a bit confusing to you? Russ can help you understand. Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Russ, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
The economy can seem mysterious, confusing, maybe beyond our control, especially if you don't work in a field related to business and money. Why is it important for the average person to think about U.S. economics?
Actually, you know, as someone who's taught undergraduate economics, that's the question I get asked usually about the six-week class. Why am I taking this class? It's really a philosophy. And what we try to do is get you to understand things like price elasticity and demand. You know, why is that important? You know, if you're going to start a business or you're going to work in a business, wouldn't it be nice to sell a product that has inelastic demand? So if the price goes up, people still have to buy it. And you know, what is inflation? I mean, We talk about, you know, there's cost push inflation and there's demand pull inflation, and which one's which, you know, and, you know, sometimes demand pull inflation, everyone wants it. I got to say this, Larry, I had you for a professor in 1978. I'm sure you get that all the time. I was undergrad in Madison in the 70s.
Oh, my gosh. Russ, I get that. I get that a lot. My dad had you for class, or my grandpa had you, that sort of thing. It's always a fun. Well, here's already we got somebody wondering, what do you do with a degree in economics? You're teaching it, so what do you do with it?
You know, I can tell you, none of my students, I play the flute, so I can say this. None of my students are playing the flute on State Street in front of a hat full of dollar bills. Maybe they are. But, you know, you basically ultimately become an analyst. You look at numbers. You have a framework for thinking of numbers, whether that be supply chain or finance. You know, I go back to myself. I graduated from Madison in 1983 with a degree in English. And I got a job in a bank. And so I was taught a philosophy of thinking that I walked into the bank and was able to adapt to the knowledge they needed me to learn. And that's what we try to do with economics, is give you the ability to learn more stuff, but have a foothold on what you're doing.
Let's take a couple of, you know, you mentioned a thing, inflation is one thing, but tariffs. Tariffs are in the news all the time. And what are tariffs? You know, they're basically a tax, aren't they?
Yeah, they are a tax. And the question becomes, are they a tax on the producer, or are they a tax on the buyer? And then how does this get divvied up? And it depends. You know, if you put a tariff on something, and I'll use bananas as an example. Put a tariff on bananas, it's a good chance a banana producer will probably eat a good portion of the tariff, because it's a what degradable, I'm looking for the term.
Yeah.
But you know, you can only leave that banana or tomato sitting in the box for so long. If on the other hand, it's a tariff on something that, you know, the company can say, take it or leave it, I'm adding the tariff to it. And if you don't want it, good for you. So it's going to be split up. So if it's 15%, it might be 10% that the consumer pays and 5% that the supplier pays. So it's not as clear cut. It just depends on, go back to the word, elasticity.
Well, and so the consumer is paying for it. A good chunk out of it.
A good chunk of it.
Yeah. And here's an, who collects that money? I mean, how's it collected, those tariffs?
Well, this is where it gets a little tricky, because the big thing for me is this de minimis tax. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Where if, you know, I'm going to bore you with a really fast story. I needed to buy a little key for my church's towel dispenser in the men's room.
Okay.
You know that key.
I know that. So a white dispenser.
Yeah.
I lost it.
I lost the key. So I went online, ordered it from China, $3. They shipped it to me for 40 cents. And it doesn't go through customs. It's in an envelope. And it ends up on my desk. I ordered two, by the way, because I'm going to lose the other one. Now, I get it, and, you know, obviously no one opened up the package, and there's no tariff on it, because how much would it cost the United States to have someone at the port looking at this stupid key?
Here comes Russ's key. We got to.
So now we've gotten rid of that, and we said, well, if it comes from overseas, it gets taxed, so we have to. And by the way, I don't know, maybe we have to look in the envelope to make sure that key isn't, I don't know, the key to something. And I don't know if we have enough customs officials to be doing all of this work. That's a lot of work. Because a lot of the stuff that you were getting from Temu or these Chinese companies, you were ordering a Larry Miller bobblehead. You know,
I kind of like that idea.
Yeah. I'd get, if it was a Ruskation, I'd get one from when I was in my 20s. But, you know, they make that on a 3D printer in China, put it in a box, send it here. It probably costs $200. That's going to cost a lot more money, because somehow, somewhere, it has to go through some process of getting that tariff. And that's a lot of the stuff we get from China was under this de minimis tariff exception.
Got it.
So get your bobblehead quick.
Well, Bob is not a bobblehead. Bob in Platteville, though, has a question. So let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
And what's on your mind?
Well, I'm not sure I'm asking if this is an economy question or not, but I'm curious as to why, for the folks that are very high wage earners, why are we cutting off their contributions to Social Security? Why are we putting a cap on that?
Okay. Boy, that's a great question. Can I answer that?
Go right ahead.
Because if you make more than, I think it's $160,000 a year, and by the way, I'm not that person, but it's a holiday in some families, because now you're not paying that contribution to Social Security, because there's a cap on how much you can get. So if you make $1 million and you paid Social Security tax all the way up to that $1 million threshold, you're still only limited to $3,700 or some number of Social Security you can actually collect. And so the Social Security Administration said, well, that's not fair. And, you know, to be frank, the only fair I know is at West Allis, it's the state fair this week. And not all taxes are fair, and it certainly would raise a little bit of money if you got rid of that threshold.
There you go, Bob.
So I'm sure I'm going to be disliked for saying that, but that's why they do it, because you're going to pay in and you're never going to get that money back.
Bob, thank you. Brendan in New Glarus, your turn now. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, how you doing? My question is regarding some of the things that have happened in the Midwest over the last, you know, couple of decades of offshoring, supply chains, factories, things of that nature. And we're talking a lot about reshoring in the news and trying to get some of those jobs back if that's possible. And I'm just curious what you could provide some information about the economic implications of reshoring jobs, if that's even possible.
It is possible. And it's called robotics and AI and 3D printers. I mean, the idea that the steel mill of today is something from Flashdance in 1985, and that the car factory is, it's if you go to a car factory today, it's a clean factory with robotics, and they don't have 5,000 people working there. And so you can reshore, and you can bring in technology that'll, because we're going to have labor problems. Yeah, not labor problems in terms of, you know, strikes, but we just have fewer people. But you're going to have more machines, more robots, and more 3D printers and that type of technology. So, yeah, it's possible.
Brendan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Taking a look at the mysteries of economics today with our guest. Oh, man. Russ Gation, economics professor at UW-Whitewater. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Russ Gation, economics professor at UW-Whitewater, our guest as we talk economics with him. At 11:45, by the way, we'll be talking about personal finance. Then we'll hear at 12:30, we'll hear about the development of a vaccine for glioblastoma. It's a type of brain tumor. So we'll visit about that later. And then right after we visit with Russ, we'll be talking about investing in personal finance. Right now, we're looking at the mysteries of economics with Russ. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234 and email to talk@WPR.org. Patsy emailed us, if Social Security is on a trajectory to go bankrupt, is it also true that our whole economy is headed toward implosion? If the economy has to keep expanding in order to keep us moving forward, would that not also keep Social Security solvent? Or if we accept that Social Security is headed for doom, do we have to ask ourselves if capitalism is sustainable in the current world? There's a big question for you.
Yeah, I was going to say there's four questions. We only have 25 minutes. Let's start with Social Security. If you think of Social Security as a triangle, you want a triangle rather than a rectangle. You want that base to be wider than the tip. The people at the tip are the people over 65. And you want the people on the bottom paying in. The challenge we're facing today is our birth rate has been going down for the last 20 years. I mean, I go back to myself. I have five brothers and sisters. I have two children. I think between the six of us, I think we have like 12, which would have made two 1960s South Milwaukee families instead of six. And so those 12 are paying for me when I retire. And so that's the underlying problem. So what we need to do is have the economy grow faster. Because every time the economy grows faster, and I said this a second ago, whether it's through robotics or technology, we're getting Social Security income coming in off of that. So growth is the only way, and a rising population at the base. And then in terms of the economy as a whole, well, first, you asked the last question. I'm a strong believer in capitalism. Strong believer in markets and incentives and work. And so, no, I think capitalism is, it's a great system. But you know, chapter 13 of every economics book is a chapter about equity. And we need to get to that chapter when we're teaching undergrads Econ 201, because the first 12 chapters are about efficiency. And, you know, without equity, it's not sustainable. And we have to be cognizant of that fact.
So by equity, you mean?
Now, everyone has a fair chance. And then the income needs to, you have to have the opportunity to make the $150,000. And that there aren't these negative externalities and there's these barriers, you know, when you go to college. You know, I came from a family neither of my parents graduated high school. And yet I was put on a trajectory where I got to go to college. Hard work, discipline, paid off. But the barrier wasn't really there. I mean, I go back to 1978, I paid $406 for my tuition. And I was able to make that $800 during the summer, you know, working and saving my money. I was a garbage man in the city of South Milwaukee, and I saved enough money to pay for college during that summer. It's a greater challenge today.
Yeah, you're right about that. There aren't many students, young people today that can make enough money in the summer to pay for their college education the next year.
Yeah, and by the way, it was a horrible job.
Yeah, I had a couple of those too back when I was making money to get myself into the next year of college as well. So I know what you mean. Another email has to do with the tariffs, and let me ask it this way: in the past, how have tariffs affected the U.S. consumer?
Well, we haven't had tariffs of this extent. People talk about the 1930s, and you know. It's a hard thing to compare. We might as well be talking about the Reformation or the French Revolution. I mean, that was 100 years ago. Things were totally different. So it's kind of hard to extrapolate that out. But I go back to the 1980s when we signed an agreement with Japan to limit the number of cars coming into the U.S. So there was intervention. We wanted to save the car industry. And Toyota and Honda and Mitsubishi said, we're only going to send so many cars. So those car prices went up. You wanted to get that the Toyota Corolla in 1988. You had to pay a premium because there were only so many of them. What did GM do? GM's prices were less, right? They had a chance, take over. They raised their price and made a lot of profit. I mean, they made the wrong choice. Instead of saying, We're gonna now take back the United States market because our cars are naturally cheaper because we can make as many as we want and the Japanese can only make so many. They said, we're gonna grab that difference and call it profit. So it depends on what the companies decide to do. If the companies decide to onshore, there could be some real benefits. I mean, I look at COVID and trying to get masks. And that kind of stuff. I mean, that was a problem. And I think sometimes tariffs, you want to make sure we're producing the right stuff in case of a national emergency. But the companies need to make choices that are reflective of this, and that becomes a question.
Well, and you wonder how do the tariffs then affect the imposed countries and their economies?
Well, look at Switzerland. You know, I mean, Switzerland in many ways sells a lot of luxury goods to the U.S. And you know, perhaps people can walk away from that. It might be a problem for Switzerland because you know that they sell a lot of very expensive stuff. I mean, does it affect Vietnam? I took off my shoe before we started to see where my New Balance shoe was made, and of course it was made in Vietnam. There's a lot of textiles coming out of Vietnam. I'm not sure they may, that economy might have to eat a good portion of that tariff to keep their people working. That would basically impoverish. It would create greater poverty in that country because now they're getting paid less in a country where they didn't get paid a lot to begin with.
Yeah, and I suppose the other option for that is finding a different market, a different place to sell those shoes or whatever product it is.
I believe in equilibrium. If they're not there, if there was another market to sell in, those shoes would be sold there too. You know, I'm not sure if there's some place where they're shoeless.
Let's talk about inflation a little bit. We haven't really talked much about that yet. How are the tariffs and inflation related?
Well, it's cost push. It's the cost is going to go up, and it's going to push up prices. You know, in intro micro, we always talk about, or macro actually, we talk about demand pull inflation. Something that becomes really, 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 really popular, and people start bidding up the price. That isn't the tariff. The tariff is the cost goes up. It's almost like the tariff's an input. The tariff's like if you gave everyone at the auto factory a raise, or if the price of steel went up, it's going into the cost basis of the product. And so it's pushing that price up.
You think about how common goods, let's say gas or milk, they regularly have volatile prices. So is that is that inflation or is it something else?
No, in fact, we used to say in agricultural economics that the solution to a high-priced milk is high-priced milk, because every farmer goes out and gets three more cows. And suddenly the supply of milk goes up and everyone has three more cows. And, you know, and that's the problem with some of the egg products, is we're always chasing price. And the turnaround time isn't instantaneous, so you make these decisions on whether I'm going to plant corn or wheat or soybeans, you know, 9 months before it hits the market, and then everyone decides to run in that direction. So the commodities are a challenge.
And so inflation is basically what causes inflation.
Usually inflation is caused by demand. You know, when one of the things with the housing market, we see the price of houses going up because we're not building enough houses. And so, you know, we're doing work down in Rock County. And the number of days that houses are on the market there is actually extremely short, because there's not a lot of houses for sale. And so the solution to that is build more houses. But that's a process. And so the demand for housing, the demand for housing in the 1970s, prices went up a lot because the baby boomers all decided they needed to buy a house all at the same time. It was like the same day. And so a lot of it is demand driven. On the other hand, some of it's cost driven. You know, if for example, if we're having trouble getting rare earth metals, price of those rare earth metals is going to go up, and it's going to cycle back to our computers and our iPhones and technology products. And that's going to push it up because of cost, because everyone's going to be bidding on that same input.
So that's cost push in inflation.
Yes, cost. Yeah.
You were talking about earlier. Then there's creeping inflation. I mean, it's a little bit at a time it goes up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not sure. That's not a technical term.
Is hyperinflation a technical term?
Well, the hyperinflation is, you know, some countries, you know, they see their prices doubling and tripling, and it causes political instability. You know, we don't see that in the United States. I mean, 8% inflation is horrible, but 100% inflation is a catastrophe.
Yeah. I'm thinking back to interest rates for a home at one point in my life were like 18%.
I was working for the bank then. Yes. And, you know, and that, you know, it was, and I think we got a little bit, we were blessed. I mean, you know, there was a point when rates were 2-3% for a home. That has an implication. I don't mean to bore you, but those people who have the 2-3% inflation interest rate homes are never going to sell them. Because if they move into another house, they're going to get a 6% mortgage. And they're going to be shocked how much more interest they have to pay. And so it's constraining. It's actually pulling back the housing supply in terms of what's on the market.
Yeah.
These people will never sell their house.
Well, I have a loan in that price range, and I don't really plan to sell my house any darn time soon.
I mean, you know, one of the things that happened in California is with Proposition, what was it, back in the 70s, your taxes couldn't go up. You know, they went up marginally, but they Proposition 13, they kept the property taxes the same. Well, those people have lived in those houses since 1978. Well, add that to 30 years, they were when they bought that house. It's constrained. These are policy issues that when we look at them 30 years later, we go, wow, look what just happened.
Yeah. John from Janesville sent an email. Will the dollar continue to be the currency of choice globally? And then how will Bitcoin affect the dollar?
I'll say on the second one, I don't know. The first one, yes. I mean, that's my opinion. And my opinion is, you know, it isn't even, it's okay, is it going to be the euro? I don't think so. Is it going to be the Chinese currency, the ruble? No. Is it going to be the yen? No. It may be a basket, but I still think that the U.S. economy continues to chug along positively. But that's, you know. But by the way, perhaps that's more of a hope on Russ's part.
Yeah. Another question about the Federal Reserve, and maybe you could just talk about what is the Federal Reserve. We're hearing a lot about the Federal Reserve in the news. And I think we've heard that from a lot of presidents over the years, concern about the Federal Reserve and how it might affect inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Paul Volcker was exactly the most popular person in the 1980s. And Alan Greenspan wasn't exactly popular. He, I think it was George Bush the first thought that he undermined his election in 1992. But basically the Federal Reserve provides guidance, and they can affect short-term interest rates by expanding the money supply. But in many ways, you know, prior to the Federal Reserve, we had a cowboy economy that was based on currency issued by banks. And what the Federal Reserve is gave stability to the economy, and it needs to continue to do that. Transparency is very important. We need to know what they're doing and why they're doing it. Federal Reserve's not perfect. They actually can make mistakes. You know, in the run up to the financial crisis in 2008, perhaps they moved a little too slow. Perhaps when they said that inflation was transitory during the COVID era, they moved a little too slow. And there are other times they moved way too fast during Richard Nixon's era. Once again, ancient history.
Yeah, yeah. But basically, the Federal Reserve is kind of trying to protect us from ourselves.
In many ways. Yeah. Because, you know, money supply is an interesting thing. If you have 10 bananas and $10, a banana's a buck. If the Federal Reserve doubles the money supply and we don't get any more bananas, we have $20 and 10 bananas, they're $2. So if they keep expanding the money supply, but the economy doesn't chug along in the same pattern, you're going to be inflationary because there's going to be dollars chasing bananas.
Yeah. So over time, you wonder how much influence politicians have had on the Fed decisions. It doesn't seem... I don't know. They're supposed to be free of the politics, are they not?
It's supposed to be, Ed, but you know, we all live in a community.
John emailed us, if America had Medicare for all, small businesses would be relieved of that cost burden, and that would help our economy. What do you think? I guess is the question here.
It's a kind of a perhaps. I'm not entirely sure. I think that we do have the availability of semi-private health insurance through Obamacare.
Yeah.
Not a health economist.
What about recession? We haven't talked about that yet. What are the signs that an economy will enter a recession?
I mean, you know, it is, the recession is basically when you sell less stuff this year than you did last year. Let's cut to the chase. We're not heading there. You know, we didn't add a lot of jobs last quarter, but we added jobs. We've grown this year. I'm very competitive. Want to grow more? That's me. Mm-hmm. I just want to grow more. But we're growing, and you have to ask yourself, why would we go into a recession? What would it be that would cause us to? Predominantly, it's because fewer people are working, or they're spending less money. We haven't seen that yet.
People are still spending.
They're still spending. They're still working. So at this point, you know, I will say I don't see it, but you know, the greater fear is that we're not growing. We've grown over the last 20 years about 2.2% a year. The fear is when we go to 1.2%.
Sounds like then a small amount, but it's big.
Yeah, 2.2%. I mean, you double your economy every like 30 years. I mean, that's a big, big thing. My goal, I always like the number 2.5. Actually, I like the number 3.
I really like the number 3.
I really like the number 3.
Jerry in Kakana has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, I have a question about these tariffs and how it's supposedly helping our economy. We're collecting that money. It looks like it's just going to pay down the federal debt so it can go out to the door to the wealthier individuals. But if we're creating less jobs, and Yale came out the other day saying every household is going to pay $2,400 more a year, that's almost like getting a pay decrease. Can you comment on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I didn't see those numbers, but, you know, people will pay more. What the number is, I'm not entirely sure. But you also have to look at whose ox is being gored. You know, when I hear, you know, we have to remember that in a county like Sheboygan County, a third of the people who work in Sheboygan County are in manufacturing. They're impacted by outsourcing. I mean, is my job at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater impacted by outsourcing? Not that much. Not that much. So we also have to think as a community, whose ox is being gored in this on the end of international trade? And we talk about efficiency. We say, well, it's efficient to buy our shoes from Vietnam. And then I drive through Port Washington by the Allen Edmonds factory. And I say, yes, it is efficient. But let's take a step back and consider the implications of this beyond my car seat when I'm driving through Plymouth, Wisconsin, or when I'm driving through Ripon with the Speed Queen washing machine factory. Yeah. These are things that we also have to have discussions about.
Justin in Madison has a question here. Justin, hi.
Hi. What I'm wondering is there's so many different numbers and so many different figures that factor into somebody getting out on a stage or on a radio report and saying the economy is doing blank. It is better or worse. However, isn't it more likely that the economy is doing better for some, worse for others, depending on what sector you're in, what you do, and what your socioeconomic status is? And if so, is there a better way that we can talk about the economy instead of these blanket statements that seem to bolster one or the other side?
That's actually where you end. I mean, it's a problem of aggregation. It's a problem of adding everything up and dividing by N. You lose the personal touch. You say, well, 9 out of 10 did better, but whatever happened to that other one? Where are they and what's happened to them? And when we look at numbers, we need to step back. We need to go a step back and ask ourselves, what happened to the individual in that average?
And on that note, Ross, it's been really interesting talking with you today. Will you come back and be with us again? Love to have you back.
Anytime I can come to Madison, I'm happy to be there.
Okay. Thanks, Russ. Russ Cation, economics professor at UW-Whitewater and director of the Fiscal and Economic Research Center at the university, our guest today. Fun talking with him. We're going to keep talking about money. Coming up, we will be talking with a financial advisor about your savings and your retirement and answer your questions in that area. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, talking now with a financial advisor about saving for retirement, about investing in the stock market, managing credit cards, and a whole lot more. And our guest is Brendan Derone, who is the CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona, Wisconsin. So as we talk with Brendan, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Let us know how you feel about your retirement account. What questions do you have about the stock market? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Brendan Derone, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
As a financial advisor, just for the basics, how do you manage people's investments?
So in my role, I manage a team that helps work with advisors that do that. So day to day, I don't do that a whole lot. But that being said, it's all about balancing risks and managing the consequences of those risks and trying to keep clients on the right track. so that they can stay in the market and keep moving forward.
Yeah. And when people talk about investment folks often talk about wealth building. What does that actually mean, wealth building?
Well, that high level, spending less than you make is a great place to start. And if you save that money somewhere else, first off, you want to have a rainy day fund just for emergencies. But ideally, you invest in something that will generate more return than when you put it in. And then at some point, when you decide that you no longer want to work, you have a pool of assets that you can draw from and have that supplement your retirement income. So you got to build that wealth if you want it to be there when you retire and you can take distributions.
Let's talk about ways here. There, we've got stocks, we've got bonds, we've got mutual funds. When you're talking to somebody, or maybe just talk about the differences among those three, stocks, bonds, and mutual funds.
Well, a stock is a little ownership within a company. A bond is debt that a company may issue, and a mutual fund could be a collection of either of those or a combination of both, in that you don't necessarily own a stock individually. You have a mutual fund that could have multiple stocks based on the type of mutual fund that it is.
And can the average person, or how does the average person typically join the stock market?
Now, there's a lot of different ways, but I would say if somebody that doesn't have any experience, work with a financial advisor, find somebody that can help you do that. Being from NAFA, that's where you got my contact information. You know, I'd encourage anybody thinking about their financial future to work with a NAFA member. NAFA is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and their members are held to, you know, high ethical standards, and they put clients first. And that would, you know, if you're looking for somebody to work with, a NAFA member would be a great person.
Yeah, and I think, what do you think? Between the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, I think there's like, what, 6,000 different stock options that you could pick from?
Yeah, there are a lot. I mean, if you wanted to invest in individual stocks, which I would say is probably not the best course for the general public, yeah, you've got a multitude of options between the different stock exchanges. You've got, you know, penny stocks, there's unlisted stocks. You know, you need to know a lot about that company if you're going to invest individually in it, in my opinion.
Yeah. And how are the prices determined for a stock?
Well, some would say it's, you know, they're not rational or it's funny math, but I would say high level, you look at a company's future earnings. You use some discount method to put that into today's dollars, and that should represent, you know, the value of the company. And then depending on how many shares they have issued, that will determine the value of that stock.
And okay, so as a financial advisor, you help clients build what's called an investment portfolio.
Correct.
Some are built on 401ks, some are on IRAs and annuities, others kind of exist on their own, if I'm not mistaken. So
those are different, I guess, tax treatments and ways that you can invest. A 401k is a, you know, a company sponsored program, and you can have, you know, some of your paycheck either before or after taxes, depending if it's a Roth 401k or not, allocated to that investment. Most companies will match in some capacity to help encourage you to do that. As 401ks have become more popular, pensions have gone to the wayside, but that's used to be how companies would help retirees, is create a pension for them and incentivize them to stay with the company long term. Now they do 401ks. An IRA, similar you know, tax treatment to a 401k, but it's just an individual retirement account. And the government has created these tax benefits to help encourage people to save for their retirement, so they're not all, you know, dependent on the government or Social Security.
Yeah. And the Roth, you mentioned Roth. The Roth IRA and a traditional IRA, a little different, and there's different limitations, I think, on at least on the Roth IRA.
Yeah, different rules on how you can contribute and, you know, what you're required to take out. The Roth IRA, basically contributions are going in after tax, and that grows, and it's tax-deferred. And then when you take the money out, you're not paying any additional taxes, where an IRA goes in before taxes, and any distribution from that comes out, you know, entirely taxable. In, you know, my opinion is that we're in a, at this point, a fairly favorable tax era, especially when you look at taxes historically. When you look at the big picture of all the things that we're doing, I think tax rates are going to have to be higher in the future. So therefore, I think a Roth IRA makes a lot of sense if somebody can contribute to that, either in a Roth 401k or individually.
Yeah, it makes sense. Helen in Madison has a question or two for you. Let's go there. Helen, hi.
Hi there. Two questions. I have just retired, and all my money is in retirement accounts, tax-deferred retirement accounts. And a big portion of that is in guaranteed annuities. So the first question has to do with whether it would help or make any sense or be pointless to hire a financial advisor to help me kind of, I don't know, deal with that. Or is that simple enough that I just need to figure out what my annuity is going to be, and I'm going to have to pay taxes on everything. So I guess I don't know if when is the situation complicated enough to benefit from a financial advisor? Is the first question.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me answer. I'll answer that one first. I absolutely think it would make sense to, you know, work with a financial advisor. I would interview, you know, a couple of them, and some of them, you know, aren't going to charge a fee up front. Others could charge a fee for a plan. Take a look at, you know, how they work and their different options. I mean, you are correct that if everything is tax deferred, you know, there's not a lot of strategy they can play from that standpoint to, you know, pull from non-qualified or if you have, you know, life insurance. That being said, it's, you know, these are the critical years in your retirement, right after you retire. Sequence of return risk is the biggest. And I think having a financial advisor and somebody else there to help coach you on that process is well worth, you know, the cost involved.
Yeah. And Helen, your second question?
The second question is kind of related to something he just said, and that is, the majority of my invested funds are in guaranteed annuities already. I'm divorced with no children and have, what's the expression, want to die with zero. So is there any reason not to just turn everything into annuities for a guaranteed stream of income, since I'm not really interested in trying to, whatever, follow the market, I guess.
Yeah, and I believe annuities are great, and they provide that income, and retirees have a lot more peace of mind with income. That being said, you never want to have all your eggs in one basket and have all of your, you know, investments, you know, in annuities when the market might be able to yield more. You don't know how long you're going to live. I understand that, you know, you're okay dying with $0, but unless you can tell me when you are going to die, I can't give you the best strategy.
On that note, Helen, if you have other questions, you can stay with us. But we're going to break for the news, but we'll be back with Brendan Durone of E4 Insurance Services in Verona in just a few minutes. Talking with a financial advisor today about saving for retirement, investing in the stock market, managing credit cards, and a whole lot more. Our guest, Brendan Durone, is the CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona. It's great to have him with us. And certainly, I hope you'll join in. Do you feel confident with your retirement saving plan? Let us know your plan, maybe. Or maybe you have a question. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Tim in Ocano, who has a question, I believe. Tim, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. About a year ago, the major company that I work for changed administrators of our 401k. And apparently one of the benefits to this is that you are able to invest with them some or all of your vested amount of money that you have in your 401k. And, you know, I amassed a fair amount of money here over the years in my 401k. I contribute to contribute heavily, and I'm 61 years old, and I don't know how much I really want to mess with this. I think this is a fairly new type of thing within 401ks. I was just wondering if you think it's a good idea, or do I just stay the course the way I've been going?
That's a complicated question. I think what they're saying you can do is an in-service distribution, and that means that you can take the money out of your 401k and manage it in any investment where within your 401k you have limited options. I don't see that as a bad thing. Do you work with a financial advisor already, Tim?
I actually work with two financial advisors, and then this administrator is a third, and everybody wants the money. Well, and they want all of it. Nobody wants a third of it to kind of test them out and see who does the best.
Yep. I would say that I'm not a fan of having multiple, financial advisors. Now, you can have people in individual specialties and may focus on that. Somebody that could, work with your insurance, somebody that could do investments. But having, multiple financial advisors is like having, three starting quarterbacks. Who's going to get the ball? Who's going to make the decisions? And, where are you going? You may think you're having diversification, but they could be all putting you in the same thing and not being diversified. So my suggestion would be to, work with either one of the two that you're already or the plan administrator on your 401k. But, again, it's also like having multiple doctors, but all generalists, not a specialty, doesn't make a ton of sense.
Yeah.
Not saying any one of them doesn't do a good job. It's just they're limited doing their job if from waist down one of your doctors treats you and from waist up the other.
Okay. Tim, there you go. Thank you. You had some decisions to make there. Let's go to Neil in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Neil.
Good afternoon. I am 61 years old, getting ready to retire and as soon as next year or maybe a couple of years, not really sure. I'm going to be relying on my Social Security. I've got a pension. I've got a healthcare savings account and another secondary retirement or savings, I guess you want to call it. And that's an IRA, so I'm deferring the taxes until I start drawing on it, I guess. I guess my theory, that my thought process there is that when I start drawing on that, I'll have less income, and so the taxes would be lower. I guess that's my first question. Is that logical thinking? And then the big question is, they always ask you, how much do you need in retirement? And I mean, how do you even figure, how do you know that? Do you have any pointers on how to,
Yeah.
Sure.
So let's Good, start with question. your first question. Yeah. In theory, yes, your taxes should be lower in retirement because you're not, you know, making money. That being said, if, and that goes right into your second question, how much do you need in retirement? If all of your money is qualified or before tax, and you're pulling out, you know, the same amount of dollars that you did, that you made, then your tax rate, you may not be in a lower, you know, tax bracket. And that's assuming all taxes stay the same. The one thing we know with government is nothing is going to stay the same, and tax rates are going to change and things are going to happen. So is it going to be higher or lower? I can't tell you for certain. But your theory is sound if everything holds true. As far as figuring out how much you need in retirement, you know, I would look at your spending today. Most of those, you know, expenses aren't going to change. If you, I mean, the one thing that could change is healthcare, especially if you retire before 65. So make sure to plan on that. That is not, you know, a little expense. And then the other thing that I would say a lot of retirees, you know, have happen is when you don't have to go to a day job anymore, you find more ways to spend your money. You want to go out and do things and travel, and that doesn't come free generally.
Yeah. Yeah. I think most of my friends find that they're spending more money than they were before. So it is something you got to think about. That's for sure. And you know, if you can think about it, well, at least what I'm making now and maybe a little more probably isn't a bad way to think.
And as I said, healthcare, I mean, even after, you know, 65, people get old. You need to have more surgeries. You got downtime. You might need help. I mean, let alone, you know, long-term care. You know, Neil, if you don't have a long-term care, you know, insurance policy, I would ask, what is your plan and what are you going to do and how are you going to, you know, take care of that? So those are all things that, you know, a financial advisor can help you with and help you figure out how to plan for those consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, though, Neil. Thank you so much for calling. Sherry in Colfax, we'll go to you now. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I have a question. My husband is going to be 70, and I'm going to be 69. And we have about $750,000 in a CD, a lump CD, and about $100,000 in Roth IRAs, and probably about $350,000 in cash. And I know at some age coming up, the government's going to tell us how much we have to take out of our saving, or out of our CD or whatever. But I don't know how to figure that out. And the bank said they don't know how to figure that out. And it seems like I'm just waiting and waiting and waiting. And do you have a clue as to how much they're going to make us take out and when?
Yeah. So, and is that CD that you have, is that qualified dollars, do you know? Is it an IRA CD?
No, it's just a regular CD, and it'll be up in a year, about June again. And then we'll have to decide what we want to do.
So then that CD, the government isn't going to make you take anything out. It's just the money that is, so you said you had $100K IRA?
That's a Roth.
Okay, that's a Roth, so again, you're not going to be
the IRA. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you have any traditional IRA or 401k?
Nope, nothing. We have, it's all liquid.
Okay. So then from what you've told me, I don't think any of your assets are going to be, you know, mandated for RMDs or required minimum distributions. So you will be okay.
Yeah. And typically RMDs, they, if I'm not mistaken, they start at one level and then they go up a little bit each year as time goes.
Yeah, so start, they start at, you know, 73, unless the rules have changed with the Secure Act 1.0, 2.0, or age 75 if you're born 60 or later. But yes, that amount or required minimum distribution percentage goes up each year you get older.
Yeah, they want to make sure they get all their tax money out of it.
You've deferred taxes from the government. They want to make sure they get theirs in due course.
Sherry, thank you for calling. Judy in Fitchburg emailed us. She has a question about property casualty insurance companies. Why are the major insurance companies like State Farm and Allstate pulling out of states or regions with high climate change related catastrophes such as floods, hurricanes, and wildfires? She thought the whole point of insurance was to price risk correctly. Don't those companies have actuaries who can correctly price the risk? Or is climate change such a huge risk that it is changing the entire insurance business model?
So the property and casualty landscape is not my specialty, but what I would say is, yes, they have actuaries and they can price that risk. It doesn't mean that people want to pay it and they can get enough. I mean, insurance by definition is the law of large numbers, and they need to get enough people to diversify that risk. But also when you look at climate change and flooding, it's, you know, those are massive claims. As a business, it's not their job to insure everybody. They've decided it does not make business sense to be in that area, which is why they've pulled out.
Hmm. Sam in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Sam.
Yes, the question is how to maximize the amount that I can leave to my descendants. I have a property that's about $500,000. I have a 401k that's about $200,000. How to leave the money to my children.
How many children do you have, by the way?
Three.
Three children? Okay.
Best way to do that is to spend less. That being said, you know, you don't want to necessarily sacrifice your life just for your kids, although I think that's what being a parent is about. You can put, you know, assuming that you are still healthy, life insurance is a great way to transfer wealth from one generation to the next. The other thing, you know, as people get older, their investments generally become more conservative, which makes sense because you want to make sure that you don't run out of money. But if you are investing for your children's benefit and not yours, you could be a little more aggressive in the market that way as well.
So I was thinking the reason I asked about the number of children is the tax rates on, if you die and pass on, in his case, what was it, about $600,000 or $700,000, that's probably not going to be, is that going to be taxed by at any rate to the children?
It really depends on what sort of investment it is in. I mean, again, if it's qualified or a annuity, there will be, you know, taxes due to the decedents. If it's in life insurance, in, you know, given the numbers that he explained, life insurance passes completely income tax free to the beneficiaries. A Roth IRA would, you know, pass tax free. The house that he mentioned, they should be able to get a step up in basis. So I think a lot of that he mentioned would be able to pass tax-free, but without doing a deep dive, I can't say for certain.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Sam, thank you. Kurt in Watertown, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am I'm 64, and I'm married, and I've got total assets between houses and cars and 401ks and another IRA of about $1 million. I'm starting to put a will together, and I'm thinking about a trust. I think it's a living trust, right, where you move things in, and I'm not quite sure if it's worth the hassle to go through that, or if it's what the value of having a living trust is. So I was hoping you could answer that.
I would say that the biggest benefit of not of having a living trust is to be able to avoid probate for you. Probate, depending on your situation, can cost anywhere to, you know, 3 to 6%, sometimes a hair more, of your assets. So that's the value in doing that. From an economic standpoint, you also have the ability to, you know, control some things from the grave. You know, if you want to decide how the money is distributed after the fact, you can put those sort of trust provisions in and again, be able to control, you know, some of the disbursement later. But given what you've said, I think a trust would make sense. I would work with a local attorney, and they can also ask some questions that can help guide what you do.
Yeah, for sure. Kurt, thank you for calling. Diane in Madison emailed us. She's retired, and all of her retirement funds are in qualified accounts. She gives generously to charities and takes the deductions when she itemizes. She'd like to use a QCD in order to reduce her gross income, but was told she can't take QCD from her qualified accounts. Wondering how to handle this. A rollover IRA? And if so, is that transaction taxable?
A rollover IRA in itself would not be taxable, as that's just, you know, moving it from, call it a 401k, to an IRA, and, you know, keeping it in that same tax status, so tax deferred. And then, you know, as far as doing a qualified charitable distribution, she can do that from an IRA. So I missed what you said her investment was originally in. It was just qualified, is what I heard.
Yeah, she said all qualified accounts.
Yeah, so assuming that it's in a 401k right now, then yes, doing a rollover to an IRA would allow her to be able to do that QCD.
Jenny, who's 30 years old, wonders what percentage of her money should she consider investing?
Well, there's not a lot to go on there. A ballpark is, you know, if you want to be on the good side, 10 to 15% of your income. But I'd want to know, you know, does Jenny have a, you know, emergency fund? Does she have disability income? You know, at her age, losing, you know, what if she gets sick or hurt? What is she going to do? Does she have beneficiaries? Does she have life insurance? You know, all these things are important steps that we want to make sure we have covered before, you know, we figure out how much we're going to invest.
Yeah. I often hear about from people who are saving to put kids through college and aren't sure how they can do that and save for retirement. What advice do you have there?
I mean, there are some vehicles that you can use that would, you know, cover both. But yeah, it's hard. Retirement is, you want to save a lot for retirement. College is not cheap. It's not getting cheaper. I know a lot of people will use, you know, something like cash value life insurance, which has, you know, tax deferred and tax free buildup. You can take loans from that to help pay for college and then later use that, you know, for retirement. It also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in that if you happen to die, now you have death benefit proceeds to help, you know, pay for your kids' college, your spouse's retirement. So there's a multitude of options, but it's not easy.
Bruce from Madison emailed, his grandmother's sister-in-law gave a trust fund, mainly dividend-paying stocks, to his grandmother, who then passed it to his father. Bruce's dad is now in his 90s and has passed it on to his three children. Bruce would like to transfer his portion from Siebert to a different brokerage that has the Think or Swim trading platform, but many of the stocks do not have a stated purchase price. what would happen in this case? Does he need to have the prices at which they were transferred to him, or how can he go about getting them?
Yeah, I mean, not a lot of detail there. It depends on how they were transferred to him. If it happened to be transferred at death, then, you know, you'd get a step up in basis at that, you know, previous owner's death. That's, you know, when that happened and he took over, that would be his starting value. But I can't hazard a guess, really.
What's the biggest mistake people typically make when they plan for retirement?
Not starting soon enough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I think you're probably right about that.
Yeah, it's compounding eighth wonder of the world. The sooner you get started, you know, the better you are. To the question before, I think, can it be done by yourself? Absolutely, but working with a financial professional really makes a lot of sense in my opinion, and I couldn't recommend more that they look for an AFA member.
Yeah, I would agree. Just one quick note of my own. I happened to come into a little bit of money at the time my daughter was born, and I put it into a college investment plan, and it was enough money to begin with, you know, $20,000, that by the time she was 18 and ready to go to college, so she had 18 years of that.
Mm-hmm.
There were no problems with that doubling every 5 or 6 years made quite a difference.
Yeah, depending on when you had it invested and what you had it invested in, there could have been some very good runs over 18 years.
There were some very good runs. And I'm really happy about that. And Brendan, really happy to have you with us today. It's been great. Would you come back and be with us again sometime again?
Happy to, anytime.
Oh, it was great. Brendan Durone, our guest today. He's CEO of E4 Insurance Services in Verona. It was great to have him with us today. Coming up, we're going to talk about some work going on about glioblastoma, a common and aggressive brain tumor. That's our next topic. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for staying with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking now about glioblastoma. It's a common and aggressive brain tumor and one of the deadliest forms of cancer. And thankfully, there's a group of Wisconsin doctors and researchers who are working on a therapeutic vaccine. And we have with us Dr. Mahua Day, a tenured associate professor of neurological surgery and director of the surgical neuro-oncology program at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in, want to hear from you. Have brain tumors affected your life, and what would a potential new treatment mean for you? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Day, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we're going to be talking about glioblastoma, and let's get to the basics first. What is it and what happens to the body if you have it?
So glioblastoma is the most common primary brain cancer. It's a brain cancer that grows from the brain itself. So there are certain cells in the brain that can become cancerous, and that gives rise to to the cancer. The symptoms are usually seizures, headaches. Sometimes you can have neurological deficits depending on which location the tumor is growing, like speech problems, motor weakness, anything, you know, our brain controls everything. So the symptoms could be wide ranging.
And who's most likely to have or to get glioblastoma?
Thankfully, it's not very common like lung cancer or breast cancer, but it's definitely one of the deadliest ones. It primarily affects older people over the age of 60, but we see them in younger people as well. If you look at the data, would suggest it's slightly more common in men compared to women, and slightly higher predominance in Caucasian population compared to others.
So it can, I assume it affects your personality, your ability to speak and think?
Absolutely. You know, brain is the most important organ. Well, that's what I think. I'm a neurosurgeon, right? But it is the computer that operates us. Yeah. So anything growing there that impairs the functioning of the brain can affect a lot. You know, many times other cancers, we do surgery, we take them out. But when you have cancer in the brain, everything we do has consequences. And the consequences really impact people's quality of life.
Yeah. And again, how many is this is, you said it's infrequent compared to other forms of cancer, but how many people are affected by it in the course of a year here in the state or maybe nationally? There are better numbers. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say, like, if we look at the overall U.S. statistics, there are about 13 to 20,000 people who are currently alive with for a year with glioblastoma alone.
Mm. So, and the outlook is apparently not good.
Yeah, it's one of the hardest cancers to treat. The average survival in the best clinical trial setting is about less, slightly over a year. And eventually the cancer always comes back.
Mm. So you can get rid of it, but it's going to come back.
That's right. So it's kind of, you know, the first line of treatment is surgery followed by chemo and radiation. And that takes care of it for the first go around. And on an average, anywhere from 9 months to 14 months, the cancer does come back. And when it does come back, then it's very, very difficult to treat.
Yeah, because I suppose you can't go through those same typical treatments if it's only been 9 months or less.
Right. And many times we can't, but many times we do go back because there's not that much option that's out there. Yeah. So we do sometimes try re-surgery depending on how patients are doing, depending on where the location is. Is it gonna, we always try to balance the risk and benefit, right? Is it gonna make you lose your mobility, then maybe the gain is not that much, versus if it's in a quieter area of the brain where we can take it out and we can give you good quality of life, that's a better strategy. So the primary focus for all of us here is to maintain a good quality of life while we are, you know, buying as much time as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And as we talk with Dr. Day, I hope you'll join in. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@WPR.org. Gianni in Montello has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, yes. I have a question about the catalyst for glioblastoma. Is there a particular lifestyle or exposure, environmental exposure, or is it genetically based? What is known at this point? What might precipitate this?
Yeah, good questions.
Now, there is no known cause, like a direct association of anything that causes. There are certain gene mutations that we find after someone is diagnosed with glioblastoma that can make it more aggressive. But this is all on the hindsight after someone gets a glioblastoma. We don't know of any modifiable factors that can prevent us from getting glioblastoma at this point.
That's too bad. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Phyllis in Windsor. Phyllis, hi to
dear.
You.
Hi. So two of my dad's siblings died from brain cancer, and I don't know what kind they had. This was some time ago. And I'm just wondering how likely that is to run in families, or did we just get a bad luck?
It would primarily depend on what was the tumor. So glioblastoma is just one of the brain cancer, but there are many different types of brain cancer. Some can have genetic component to it, some don't. So without knowing exactly what kind of tumor it was, it's hard for me to comment on that.
Yeah. Which ones have a genetic component to them?
There are certain genetic diseases like neurofibromatosis, you know, that NF2 gene, and they can have certain types of brain cancer or brain tumors that we can screen for that has like genetic component associated with it, versus gliomas usually don't have strong genetic lineage where it can like pass down from one person to another person.
I got it. Phyllis, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Maybe see if you can study a little more and you can maybe learn more about the tumors that the cancer that affected your family members. I'm sure you've looked, but maybe try again. You know, there's no cure for this glioblastoma, but that's kind of where you come in. Let's talk about what you study.
Right. What we are trying to do is we developed a cancer vaccine that we tested in mice, and we're kind of optimizing in mice. So as I mentioned, we can't stop people from getting glioblastoma since we don't know what causes it. But once someone is diagnosed with glioma, with glioblastoma, it always comes back. So if we can stop it from coming back, that would be a great win against this disease. So where my lab comes in is with collaboration with my research collaborator, Dr. Gallup, who we developed this cancer vaccine. So what we do is when I do the surgery, take the tumor out from patient's brain, we take the tumor to our lab and we genetically modify the tumor to a point that the tumor can secrete some immune-modifying cytokines that acts as a vaccine. The ones that we give it back to, in this case, we're right now testing in mice. When we give it back to mice, it trains the mouse's immune system. And the goal would be the same thing for patients, that we will make the vaccine from their tumor and we will give it back to them after the surgery. And this tumor in the form of a vaccine will train their immune system to recognize any residual cancer cells, which they're always, like, I can surgically take out everything I can see and everything an MRI can see, but there are always residual microscopic cancer cells. Those are the cells that give rise to the cancer that comes back afterwards. But our immune system, if we train our immune system, they can recognize these microscopic cancer cells and attack and kill them before they had a chance to give rise to the recurrence.
That is fantastic and amazing, actually. How's your research funded?
So, you know, there's multiple ways, some funded by Department of Defense, some funded by our partner at Wharf Therapeutics, who have been very gracious collaborators in this, and departmental funding. So a project like this requires, you know, developing therapeutics is a daunting process and requires many sources of funding. So we try to do our best to get, you know, as many people interested in our work and get the funding to keep the work moving.
Well, with something like this, and you're really showing progress in this, in your experiments so far, let's hope that funding can keep coming for sure. David in Prescott has a comment. Let's go there. David, hi.
Hi. I'm just curious. We have, just in the last 2 years, two very close friends, not related, just friends, have each passed away from this disease. My question is that transmittable? Is it a transmittable disease?
Hmm.
No, it is not a transmittable disease.
So that was just bad luck, I guess, on your friend's parts there, David.
Yeah.
And it's too bad. Thank you for calling. Gene emailed us. Gene's brother passed away of glioblastoma within a year of being diagnosed. For many years, he cleaned floors at night with headphones on, listening to music. Gene's wondering, could that have had contributed to his getting the brain tumor? He also had a myotonic dystrophy. He was 47.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is no published literature that kind of points to a true cause and effect for it. I mean, this is a devastating disease. And I feel like lately we're hearing more and more people with this disease and how devastating it is for families who get diagnosed. Probably we won't know for another 5 to 10 years if the incidence rate is actually increasing or not. And because some of these, like, environmental data takes a long time to really shape and give us feedback, but I do hear a lot more people with stories. And I don't know, it may be just, like, you know, the bias because I treat this disease, so I hear a lot more, but I do get the sense that I do hear a lot of people who have been diagnosed with this cancer.
Dr. Mahua Day is a tenured associate professor at Neurological Surgery and is director of the Surgical Neuro-Oncology Program at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Great to have her with us. You can join in, number 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking with Dr. Mahua Day today, a tenured associate professor of neurological surgery at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we've zeroed in on brain tumors and in particular glioblastoma. Dr. Day and her associates are working on a vaccine that can be given to people who have glioblastoma, who have had their surgery and other treatments. So this vaccine would prevent the glioblastoma from reappearing, and some really positive results so far. Tom in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Day. Yeah, my brother, 65, down in Texas, has glioblastoma. They did surgery. He seems to be doing fine right now. Two questions. Is DOGE affecting the funding for your research, Dr. Day? And also, would I need to bring my brother up to Wisconsin to get this vaccine?
So, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your brother. I know it's a difficult time. It's a difficult decision. The DOGE is affecting all avenues of funding, and you know it's a trickle down effect. It affects like NIH funding has been limited. Universities are getting lesser federal dollars from many different sources, so it definitely slows down our work. We are still in preclinical setting. We are planning to put an application to FDA for getting permission for starting a phase one trial, but that process is, again, a very costly process, and with also the personnel cut at FDA, things are slowing down on that end, how fast they review application to approve new therapies. So unfortunately, we are not in a position right now to start human trial. We are still in the process of filing for that new investigational drug status so we can start the trial. And the current landscape is definitely going to slow the process for us.
It's unfortunate. Tom, I'm sorry to hear about your brother. Thank you very much for calling. Kit in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, Kit.
Hi there. I am calling because my husband died just almost 5 years ago from a large glioblastoma, right frontal lobe cancer. He did have surgery to remove it at Mayo Clinic. He had been 15 years treated for chronic leukemia and was in remission. He also had had metastatic melanoma and had been watched for 5 years at Mayo Clinic and had no reoccurrence. So when this, he didn't have headaches. He didn't have what would ever have led me to believe he had anything for brain issues, except that he was beginning to become confused and not paying attention to things he normally took care of. So when we ended up, and then he started just failing. I was having to help him get dressed, and
yeah.
So we did go back to Mayo Clinic, not knowing what it was, and from the emergency room they did a CAT scan and came back and told us he had a brain tumor, and he did live for 2 months after the surgery. We elected not to do chemo or radiation. And our doctor at Mayo Clinic said we made the right choice. Hmm. He was never in pain. He was pleasant. he hallucinated some, but it was just a very unexpected and confusing diagnosis.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really sorry to hear that. But, that's the thing. You know, our brain is a very sophisticated organ. It has very defined areas that do different things. So right frontal lobe and, you know, someone will have confusion. That kind of makes sense because our frontal lobes are that does more like executive function, like high-level thinking. makes us kind of human. It makes us who we are, help us perceive things. So when that area gets affected by tumor, we see these kind of symptoms where just failure to thrive, not wanting to do things, but, you know, confusion, not being able to do things that you were able to do before. And many times, unfortunately, people chalk those as like, oh, we're just getting old. And that could be, you know, very confounding, especially in older age, because we dismiss so many things. I'm just getting tired because I must be getting old. But in those areas of the brain, cancer can grow and can be delayed in diagnosis because we just don't think much of those kind of quote-unquote softer symptoms.
Yeah. Kid, I'm sorry. And thank you for sharing that with us. Michelle in Benson, your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Well, my first question was answered. It was about whether she's experimenting on human beings, and she hasn't gotten to that point yet, using human beings in their trials. But I have another question. Now I'm nervous, and let's see if I can remember it. Some of the percentages that might be available on, like how many farmers that deal with pesticides are dealing with this kind of cancer. What are the percentages of life expectancy in the group that she presented that was 9 months to 14 months after the surgery? Like how many people are in that group? What a percentage?
Sure.
So we don't really have specific data for, say, farmers who get diagnosed because our data is just not that granular right now for me to really comment on that. In terms of the 9 to 14 months, that's the average. Like if you think of whenever we think of data, it's kind of like a bell-shaped curve, where the middle of the bell-shaped curve is the average we quote, and that's where, like, 92. And then there are people, like our last caller who mentioned her husband only lived 2 months. We have on one side of that bell curve tail where they just don't do well from the very beginning. And then we also have some long-term survivors that are on the other side of the bell-shaped curve who are 4 or 5 years out from their initial diagnosis.
So it's definitely varies a bit, but on the average, that's what you can expect, I believe. Well, Dr. Day, are you optimistic?
Yes. Everything we do because we have hope. We can, you know, that's what we do in my lab every day. And we are determined to bend the curve for this disease and provide people hope and time and kind of, you know, stop the disease. So, yes, absolutely.
Well, that's good to hear. You're doing wonderful work, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Dr. Mahua Day is a associate professor of neurological surgery, director of the Neurological Neuro-Oncology Program at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And let's hope that there's money available to keep this research moving forward, because it's been very optimistic so far in her work. And thank you for joining us today. This and all our programs, a team effort, our producers, Clara Niper, Joel Patnod, our directors, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening, and please do stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.